This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website.
My name is Torsten Bell, I'm the Chief Exec of the Resolution Foundation. Now, the Chancellor had been hoping this was going to be a very quiet affair. We were going to get some little forecasts from the Office for Budget Responsibility, some good news on the public finances that was going to be pocketed away, and then he was going to say, I'll see you in the autumn for my new recovery plan and the rest. But as if the last 2 years hadn't already taught us this in spades, you have life as it turns up, not as you would like it to be. And that is not where we are today, where the defining economic feature of the year is surging inflation. And the defining policy question that leaves for the Chancellor is, what do you do in the face of that inflation? So that's the kind of framing for a lot of what we're going to discuss this morning. What is the nature of that inflation squeeze on households? What was the policy response set out by the Chancellor? How does that measure up against the goals that he has set himself? And I should start by thanking the whole Resolution Foundation team, a good chunk of which have been up overnight producing our overnight policy response document, which I can't wave in front of me. I can. One of these guys can wave it. Here we go. It's basically like we've got like a kind of communist Pravda style. Everyone's on branding message, right? So go and read that on the website. Thank you very much to the team for all the hard work, including James Smith, one of our research directors here, who's going to give you a summary of it shortly. And after he's finished, please ask any questions you've got about the analysis or about anything else you want to ask. It's on Slido as ever, and it's hashtag Spring Statement. And then after James, you're going to hear from Richard Hughes, who is the chair of the Office for Budget Responsibility, who gave us the forecast that underpinned the policy decisions taken by the Chancellor yesterday. If you're squeamish about your own personal finances, maybe turn off when he's giving you a summary of what they mean for you. He's a tough man. Then you're going to hear from Gemma Tetler, who's the Chief Economist at the Institute for Government, maybe touching on some of what this means for public services. And the government also announced a tax strategy document, which is worth a giggle and a read, if nothing else. And then you're going to hear from Robert Peston, who is the political editor of ITV News, but previously done lots of other jobs in this space, and is going to tell us what on earth where this means for the future of British economic policymaking and British politics, where obviously we're now promising we're moving into a new tax-cutting era, even if it looks a lot like a tax-rising one. So that is the plan for this morning. Hope that's what everyone was expecting. James, kick us off.
All right. Thanks, Torsten. Welcome to this early event. Thank you all for getting up early to come and do this, but I think people have been already pretty busy this morning, so hopefully everybody's ready for this. So my job is to give you all a whistle-stop tour of the spring statement. So great speakers to follow, so I'll try and be as brief as possible. As Torsten says, plenty more in the document, and thanks so much to Resolution Foundation colleagues for staying up to all sorts of ungodly hours to put that together. So Let me set the scene by setting out two tasks that the Chancellor really set himself for this spring statement. So the first was to support households in the face of a huge cost of living crisis, and the second was to set up those tax cuts he has been very open about and try and prepare the ground for all that to come. So how did he do on those two tasks? Well, let me start with the support for the cost of living crisis. And here, the really key context is this inflation forecast from the OBR. So absolutely unprecedented inflation rising to the highest in 40 years towards the end of this year. So a really big jump in inflation reflecting what's happening both in terms of pre-existing inflation, but also what's happening in the Ukraine and how that's exacerbating things. So we're going to get a huge hit to living standards just from this higher inflation. So the OBR was telling us yesterday that this would be the biggest on record going back to the 50s. And the outlook for GDP is weaker as a consequence. So this is really the key economic context to all that the Chancellor talked about yesterday. So what did he announce in response to all that? Well, this slide just summarises briefly what the key measures were. So we had the 5p cut in fuel duty, which will save the typical driver about £75 and will reduce petrol pump prices by about 13 to 15% of the rise that we've seen over the past year. So it's small in that context. He also announced an increase in the NICS threshold to line that up with what's happening on the income tax side, and that will really cancel the rise in national insurance for people earning under about 30k. And then there was a small increase in the household support fund. And what was really striking, I suppose, from our perspective, and what will really shape the analysis that I'm about to show you, is there wasn't anything that was announced yesterday that really addresses head on the 11 billion cut to benefits that we're getting from the higher inflation. It's also worth mentioning that we should view what was announced yesterday in the context of announcements in February that also introduced a council tax rebate and an energy rebate. So I'll say a little bit about how those fit in as well. But if I focus in on what was announced yesterday, this chart just shows you who gains from yesterday's announcements. You can see that there is broad support here, but only £1 in every three goes to the bottom half of the income distribution. So that's really important because it's the bottom half of, and particularly those on low incomes who are spending a higher share of their incomes on energy and other bills. And the key reason for this is basically that fuel duty benefits drivers who tend to be on high incomes, and the national insurance threshold really doesn't help anyone who isn't working or earning very low wages already. If I add in everything that's basically hitting family incomes this year, so those measures that I mentioned a moment ago that came up in February, but also tax changes, you can see the impact is much more progressive. But a key point to keep in mind here is that in cash terms at the bottom, you're sort of seeing a plateauing of the amount of boost in cash terms. And if you compare that sort of approaching £500 boost to those at the bottom with a huge rise in typical energy bills, so well over £1,000 on OBR expectations at the moment, then you can see there's big hits to cash flow for those on low incomes. So number crunching overnight from the team at RF, very impressive to do this so quickly that really models the impact of these policies and the overall economic environment from the OBR. This chart shows you the headlines from that analysis, and you can basically see this year you get an extremely sharp fall of nearly 4% in typical incomes. That's the worst in nearly half a century, and is worth over £1,000 in terms of that hit to typical incomes. Unfortunately, that hit is larger at the bottom of the income distribution, which reflects the things we were just talking about. So 6% for the bottom quartile. So a really large hit, really striking hit there at the bottom. And this is set to be the worst Parliament on record in terms of this metric, of this key living standards metric that we look at. Unfortunately, the sort of depressing additional context here is a large rise in the offing in terms of poverty. So these charts just show you absolute poverty for people on the left and children on the right, and you can see that you generally expect absolute poverty to fall continuously over time. That would be a sort of normal state of affairs, but we're now looking at a rise of about 1.3 million people in terms of poverty, around 500,000 children. So a depressing implication of the lack of support at the bottom there. So let me turn to the sort of second part, the second task that the Chancellor sets himself, which is to sort of realise that ambition for cutting taxes in the future. We got some announcements on the shape of what's to come. So 1p off income tax was the sort of rabbit out of the hat from the Chancellor yesterday. But this chart really, it's complicated. You can look at it at your leisure, but this tries to compare the tax cutting that we got yesterday, so the income tax cut, and what's happening on the threshold for national insurance in 2024-2025 to pre-announced other tax raising, so the fiscal drag from thresholds and the increase in the rate on national insurance. And then, as you can see, Rishi Sunak can't yet claim to be a tax cutter. We've got 27 million out of 31 million workers ending up paying more tax on this basis. So, you know, despite some giveaways yesterday, still tax rises are the kind of key feature here. And if I zoom out to the macro picture, you can see that tax as an overall share of the economy is at historically high levels and has been rising. And the increase in the tax to GDP share equates to around £3,000 per household. That's not, it's not a bill turning up at everyone's house, but it just brings home exactly what the scale of the rise here is. So what about future tax rises? What does yesterday tell us about the scope for future tax cutting? Well, this chart basically looks at changes in earnings in five-year forecast periods and changes in debt. So what it's basically saying is, how often do you get changes in earnings and changes in the public finances? How do they happen? You can see, typically, you get falls in earnings and a deteriorating public finances, or improving earnings and improving public finances. And the dot on the bottom left-hand quadrant, which is the OBL forecast yesterday, is extremely unusual. So the public finances are doing much, much better than family finances and making the Chancellor's life much easier. This chart just shows you that in terms of changes to the forecast. So huge upside news in receipts, the second fiscal event in a row where we've seen that. It's a historically huge increase in tax receipts. That's assumed to be lasting. The OBL see that as a tax-richer economy that we have now. And that is really sort of key context. So that's the sort of red bars pushing down on borrowing. And you can see that the spending measures announced yesterday offset that to a large degree, but overall the Chancellor spent about a fifth of his sort of underlying improvement in the public finances. And what you can see as a result of that is an incredibly sharp fall in the deficit. So the deficit is now falling three times quicker than in the 5 years after the financial crisis. A much, much quicker fall in the deficit. And with 28 billion of headroom on the fiscal mandate, the Chancellor has room for manoeuvre going forward. But the key thing to keep in mind is, particularly with the situation in the Ukraine, ongoing cost of living crisis, this is the right thing to do in terms of keeping room for policy if things turn out to be worse. That's basically it from me, just in terms of key takeaways. We're obviously dealing with this huge cost of living crisis, but the improvement of the public finances really helped the Chancellor deal with that. How did he do on his two tasks? Well, he prioritised tax cutting, but although we still have more people, we still have a lot of people paying, the vast, vast majority paying more tax, and we see not enough support, particularly for those on low income. So he really came up short on both of those key tasks, but there's plenty more to come, I think, in terms of talking about these issues, and the Chancellor kept his powder dry for changes ahead of the upcoming election.
Great, thank you, James. So, Richard, basically, you gave all of us really bad news about our finances and gave the Chancellor good news. What is your excuse?
Well, I think the news has been mixed on both sides, I would say, and but you're right, it is a more challenging economic outlook than we had expected back in October. But as James pointed out, I mean, there were, inflation was picking up even last autumn before the Russian invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February. That happened in the middle of putting together our forecast, and it basically provided another shock to global energy markets, as well as to the inflation outlook for the UK. But I mean, inflation was running at 6% in the numbers we saw yesterday. Much of that inflation was driven by the supply bottlenecks that we were talking about last year as being the big driver of inflation, this kind of global mismatch between recovering demand for goods, especially in North America, and Asia struggling to provide those goods to these countries who were emerging from the pandemic and reopening. That was driving goods inflation. That was also pushing up the prices of primary materials. You heard a lot of that from businesses already that they were struggling with. The costs, dealing with supply delays, supply bottlenecks, rising costs of doing business, and also rising costs of energy because all these manufactured goods require energy to produce. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has essentially introduced a supply shock to that equation, and pushed up energy prices dramatically. While we're putting together our forecast, the gas prices doubled. The oil price topped $100 a barrel. And it is important to bear in mind that there is huge uncertainty about the outlook for energy prices. And oil and gas prices are a huge driver of inflation here in the UK. We rely on oil and gas for about 3/4 of our energy supply, compared to sort of just over 50%, 50 to 60% for the rest of Europe. So what happens to the oil and gas price matters a lot for domestic inflation here in the UK. It's a big determinant of what's driven the increase in inflation in our forecast. When we took a read of the markets to put together our forecast, the price of gas was around £3 per therm. And just to give you a sense of the volatility, it went up to £5 per therm in the immediate aftermath of the invasion. It's since dropped back a bit since then. So there is more than the usual amount of uncertainty built into our forecasts for inflation this time around. And that, you know, that also speaks to the point that James is making about keeping one's powder dry to see what actually happens. Our predictions about what's likely to happen to energy prices in April are much more certain than our predictions about what's likely to happen to energy prices in October. But based on what you currently see in the energy markets, you're looking at a more than 50% rise in April and another 40% rise in October. But that, you know, that's premised on the idea that gas prices stay where they are, which of course depends on the course of what happens in the war in Ukraine. In terms of what it means for the outlook for the global economy, we knocked about 0.5 percentage point off global GDP. Nobody else had done a forecast for the global economy since the invasion, so that was our preliminary estimate about what it does to global growth. For the UK economy, we took down our forecast for this year from 6 down to 3.8%, which is still very healthy growth by historical standards, but a lot of that was catch-up growth from the pandemic. We go back to our usual sort of one and a half to one and a quarter growth as you get out to the medium term. But the mismatch between the 8.7% peak inflation that we're expecting this year and then what we're actually getting in terms of real earnings growth out of the economy means you get a very big squeeze in living standards this year, and a much bigger one than we thought was going to happen back in October. We actually thought living standards were going to start to recover this year. Instead, they're going to fall by around 2.2%. That's their biggest financial year fall on record. About 2/3 of that is due to the fact that inflation is outpacing earnings, and so eroding the real value of what people are getting in terms of pay and incomes. About 1/3 of it, though, is due to the fact that taxes are still set to go up from next month. We have the 1.25% rise in national insurance. That more than offsets what the Chancellor announced about increases in the personal allowance for national insurance in his spring statement yesterday. I mean, the Chancellor did provide significant sum of near-term support to help people with energy costs in the coming year. There was £18 billion worth of support provided. That offsets around 1/3 of that total fall in living standards that we're seeing in the next 12 months. So if he hadn't acted, it would have been more like something higher than 3%. And then over the medium term, as James pointed out, there are also some tax cuts, a 1p cut on income tax. But it is important to put that number in context. This is a Chancellor who has raised about 3% of GDP in tax, put the tax burden up to its highest level since the late 1940s. And so what he announced in terms of medium-term tax cuts, permanent tax cuts, were only about 1/6, undoing about 1/6 of what he's already announced in terms of tax rises since he became Chancellor. But I think you know it's important to bear in mind that you know these are decisions that he's made at the moment. There is a huge amount of uncertainty within our forecast, much of it being driven by global geopolitical developments. Small changes in gas prices up or down can have big changes on the outlook for inflation. He's got himself about £30 billion worth of wiggle room against his fiscal targets to balance the current budget and get debt falling by the middle of the decade. That could easily be wiped out by all sorts of fairly modest shocks to the economy, sort of you know, just over 1% rise in the effective interest rate, and another inflation shock of the sort that we've seen recently could do the same. And I think it's important also to bear in mind that the public finances are also feeling the inflation squeeze, in the sense that there was a lot of attention paid to the fact that you know we gave the Chancellor a big tax windfall from our forecast, because it seems to be the case that basically tax revenues held up much better during the pandemic than we thought, both income tax revenues and also corporation tax revenues. And that was down to the Chancellor's success in managing the economy through the pandemic. A lot of support was provided to households and businesses through the pandemic. A lot of that then came back in buoyant tax revenues when people paid it back to governments. It came back from income tax. It came back from the fact that you had corporations making profits rather than going bankrupt and failing. And so he reaped some of the dividends of that from the support that he provided during the pandemic. But he also faced the fact that inflation's gone up. Lots of things that governments do are linked to inflation. 30% of the government's debt stock is linked to inflation. There was a big spike. There is to be a big spike next year in debt interest costs. As a result, they got up to £83 billion in 1 year, which we've never seen before here in the UK. Over the medium term, interest rates are higher because inflation expectations are higher. That took another £9 billion off the windfall that we gave him. Plus, you've got welfare benefits being indexed to inflation, albeit with a lag, so they're not quite keeping pace with inflation, but they also get indexed. So inflation is not unalloyed good news for the public finances either, especially when so much of your debt is linked directly to inflation. And you know, depending on what you do with benefits, you also feel the squeeze there. So it's not, but you know, the Chancellor is also feeling the squeeze on his public finances as households are in the UK.
Very good. Okay, well, that's good to know that it's bad for everyone. Thanks, Richard. Perking is up first thing in the morning. Right, Gemma, what do you think?
So a few words about public spending, since we haven't really touched on that yet. Basically, it was a very simple story on public spending yesterday, that the Chancellor had set out his plans for public service spending back in October, and he didn't change them yesterday. That's in kind of two important contexts. One is there's obviously been a lot of discussion and pressure for more defence spending since the war in Ukraine. There, the Chancellor's pushback was, we knew Russia was a threat. That was built into our plans in the integrated review and into our spending review plans in October. So nothing more on that side. The other important context is obviously what higher inflation means for public services. And so no extra money has gone into public services to compensate for that. Now, if you'll allow me a slightly kind of techie segue into it.
That's literally what we are here for, Gemma. Come on.
So normally when we talk about public service spending and we talk about real terms growth in that, we tend to deflate the cash numbers by the GDP deflator. And on that basis, the hit to inflation doesn't look so bad, because the GDP deflator essentially measures what's the increase in the price of things that we produce in the UK. That's not so impacted by the things that have driven consumer price inflation, particularly high energy prices. So GDP deflator growth has gone up since October, and that means that the plans for public service spending over the spending review period on day-to-day spending now look like real terms growth of 2.9% versus 3.3% in October. So it is a bit less generous than we thought it was back in October, but not as bad as you would think if you thought that the CPI inflation numbers were feeding through into the GDP deflator as well. Having said that, obviously what really matters for how tight is this squeeze on public services is what do public services need to spend that money on, and how much are those prices going up? Half of day-to-day public service spending goes on wages. So one really big question is what happens to public sector wages this year. And one thing that was in the OBR forecast yesterday was an expectation that economy-wide nominal wages are now going to grow this year by 5.3% versus an expectation of 3.9% back in October. So if that's reflected in public sector wages, then that puts much more pressure on those budgets. The Chancellor clearly hope that they can hold down public sector wages more. The OBR points out in the document that that has been the case for the last decade or so. Having said that, having done it for a decade, there are growing signs of problems with recruitment and retention in the public sector. Some of that eased during the pandemic when there weren't great private sector opportunities, but that's really has started to reverse already. So that's a definite pressure on public services, and we'll need to watch closely what happens with the recommendations from the pay review bodies later this year. The second thing is obviously what are public services do also spend their money on things like energy. So it may be that the pressures on the public service budgets are more than are reflected in that GDP deflator number. Second thing I thought I'd mention is the tax strategy. It's a real one for nerds. I mean, I was really kind of enthused, and this shows my personal preferences, before that the leaked idea that there would be a tax strategy coming. I thought this could be something we've been calling for a long time to help shape the decisions around tax. And I have to say, I was deeply underwhelmed by what came out, which was a document.
What
very,
do you want? Look at those pictures.
I mean,
look how happy the family is. These ones are shopping. Look how good, that's what a tax strategy looks like to
that's
me.
That's what sharing growth means. I mean, there's lots of big font and there's lots of pictures, but it's pretty limited in the way of strategy. If I was being generous, there is more in the way of strategy on business taxes, where there is a clear statement of wanting to incentivize through the tax system investment in people, capital and ideas. And I think the real test will be in the autumn budget when we see what policies come out of that, whether that really lives up to a strategic view of business tax. There is nothing on strategy when it comes to personal taxes, and looking at what Sunak has done so far, it's very hard to discern any strategy there. If you take the kind of what changes have been made to income tax, you could make a reasonable economic case that he has done a sensible thing of trying to broaden the base and lower the rate of income tax. So he's frozen the personal allowance and is planning to cut the basic rate from 20% to 19%. But if you then broaden out your scope and think about what's happening with national insurance, that's going in exactly the opposite direction. He's shifting the tax burden from income tax onto national insurance. National insurance is a narrower base, less efficient version of income tax. Very hard to see what the rationale there is, and this document certainly doesn't explain the rationale for doing that. I'll leave Robert to talk about the politics of this. The thing that's mentioned in the tax strategy is a desire to review reliefs and allowances in the tax system before the autumn. If they're going to seriously do that, there needs to be a much more serious outline of what do we think the tax system is actually trying to achieve that would allow you to assess, do these reliefs and allowances contribute towards that? So I'd really hope that that's the thing that the Treasury will be working very hard on and giving us some sense of, is the structure that they'll use to make that judgment. Final very small point on levelling up, which was notably absent until I think the last sentence of the Chancellor's speech. We had the Levelling Up White Paper back at the start of February. This was one of the big manifesto pledges from the government. There's been scepticism about whether the Treasury has really bought into this whole agenda, and yesterday didn't do anything to kind of suggest that they really were. As I say, it wasn't mentioned in the speech. The White Paper suggested that Whitehall was going to be rewired so that spatial considerations would be part of every policy decision. There is absolutely zero evidence from the spring statement that spatial considerations were thought about or helped drive the policies that were announced yesterday. So I think some concern that that's not really yet baked into what the government's doing.
Very good. Thank you very much, Gemma. It's good to be enthusiastic about the principle of tax strategy, even if you can't get your enthusiasm up about the actual strategy in front of you. So, Robert, are they going to win the election?
I mean, it's one of those occasions where one feels there's so much to discuss that it's probably better just to go through my headlines and then leave time for questions. I mean, my big headline at the moment, which I've been concerned about now for some months, is that I do think we face bigger economic uncertainties than actually pretty much at any point in my adult life. You know, I am more anxious about the outlook than I was you know, when reporting that, you know, Northern Rock was going bust, or... No, seriously.
Right, well, so thanks for that flashback.
Or indeed, you know, during the uncertainties over COVID, because in all of the previous occasions where one has faced these challenges, you know, it has been possible to talk about how you fix the problem. And actually, this feels much more like the 70s, where we have, actually all over the world, quite a lot of rudderless governments when it comes to policies to deal with some really profound economic changes. And the big issue for me, which I don't know the answer to, and you know, we've got some great experts here, but I do think this is going to drive politics all over the West, is whether we are seeing a big structural change to the shape of the global economy, and that we're, therefore this rise in prices is in a sense a one-off readjustment, which will be very painful over a period of a few years, or something that could turn into something more pernicious over a longer period. And I don't know the answer to that. And I don't think anybody can be confident about any of that at the moment. So I do think, you know, we do have to recognise that the scale of the uncertainties, I'm not forecasting that this is going to turn out to be significantly worse than Richard says, I'm just saying, and I'm actually pretty much capturing some of the things that Richard said, that, you know, this is a time of profound uncertainties. And looking around the room, there are a smallish number of people who, like me, remember the 1970s. And I spent quite a lot of my time saying that the 70s was a very underrated decade. And what I mean by that is actually, you know, if you were a teenager in the 70s, culturally and all the rest of it was wonderful. But economically and politically, it was an utter mess. And the current period feels to me a lot like the 70s, where it's extremely difficult when you look at this government to, frankly, get a sense of what the fundamental ideas are, what the strategy is. You know, Rishi Sunak, May's lecture was, you know, perfectly all right on its own terms, you know, looking at how we our R&D and our capital investment is less than many other comparable countries, and you know, it obviously would be a very good thing for the long term if we could increase them. Whether or not tax breaks are the best tool to do that, again, there's a, you know, much to be discussed there. And many of us have long taken the view that the fundamental driver of productivity is market access and market size. And, you know, we did do, many people would say, an act of pretty big self-harm not that long ago when we, you know, put up the cost of access to one of our biggest markets. Again, this is something that Richard goes into some detail about in the OBR. We are against, in some pretty fundamental sense, some quite big headwinds, you know, when it comes to the big issues, like how do you get productivity up and how do you grow the economy. So those are my big and not very optimistic thoughts. One other dog that's not yet barked, but I think it is going to bark, is we've also lived now in for a fairly long period where we've just seen central banks as the great rescuers in all situations and the great fonts of economic expertise. And there are two reasons why I think central banks and the credibility of central banks are going to face a very profound challenge in the coming months. One is that this is patently not a situation which, you know, monetary policy will do, you know, if we stick to the conventional approach of putting up interest rates to combat the actual and perceived rises in inflation, a lot of poor people are going to get even poorer, and that's not going to make, you know, the credibility of central bank in the public mind any greater. But they've actually also done themselves quite a lot of harm. I mean, many of us were saying months ago that this inflation issue was not trivial and not a temporary phenomenon. And across the world, and, you know, central banks, frankly, if they'd started raising interest rates earlier, We would have, they would themselves be in a better position now. They're now in this really terrible position where, living standards across the West, but particularly in the UK, under intense pressure. And, the Bank of England is, and, the Fed and the ECB are broadly saying we're going to make it worse. And so I do think there's going to have to be a debate about how central banks get through this period. And I think it is very related to my first point, which is this a relatively temporary structural change in the economy, in which case we could be slightly more relaxed about essentially central banks not raising interest rates significantly in these circumstances. But if it isn't, in a couple of years' time, the cost base of the West will have risen because we've basically taken back manufacturing from, China, because, there are all sorts of reasons why increasingly in this bifurcated world, partly, accelerated by Russia, why, we may have to reconfigure the way we do our manufacturing and our sourcing. And of course, the cost of energy is going to go up in a secular way, simply because we can't rely on Russian oil and gas. So, but if these things take 2 or 3 years just as a sort of reconfiguration exercise, then I think we can be slightly more relaxed about not pushing up interest rates significantly. But if, there is something else going on and, pay starts to take off and all the rest, then that's a different issue. So, as again, my original point, I do think, these are profoundly challenging times, and for that reason, I also think it's almost impossible to make a rational political prediction at the moment, because there's just too much in play.
Very good. Well, I was going to say thank you, but that was even more depressing than Richard. But you get a thank you anyway. Okay. We've got a bit under half an hour to try to dissect that. We've got lots of great questions. As I was saying, for those of you online, you can put your questions in on Slido, #SpringStatement. If you're in the room, you can use the hand-raising device, which works like this if you've forgotten. We'll manage to get a mic to you. Right, let's briefly then, we've got loads of questions, okay? So let's briefly go through this on what's going on with the economy, what's going on with the public finances and household finances. What did the Chancellor do, and what the hell is going to happen? What's actually going on for the medium term? We've got 20 minutes, people. You need to be disciplined in what we are doing. So let's go. We've got questions covering all of those. So on the economic forecast, let's go through some of these. Richard, you're going to take the brunt of this because they're your forecasts and life's not fair. So first of all, right, John, if we can bring this up on the screen, the very popular question, 10 thumbs up, we're a democracy here, everyone. Basically says, why on earth do you think inflation's going to drop so fast? It's way worse than you said, Richard. Stop being so perky.
All right, so it doesn't drop down as quickly as we thought back in October, or the Bank of England thought when they were last did their monetary policy report. So on an annual basis, so it peaks at 8.7, on an annual basis, it's a bit above 7. This year, it then drops back to 4 next year, which is still well above the Bank of England's target, and in previous epochs would have been thought of still being quite high inflation, and that's a function of two factors. One is that's partly reflects what markets think is still going to be happening to energy prices globally, which is that the futures curves, they do drop back, but they don't drop back that quickly. So there is some expectation that there is lingering higher costs in energy markets, either because they think the conflict in the war in Ukraine is going to go on for longer, or they think that sanctions are going to be in place for longer, and it takes longer to bring more supply on stream.
So basically, you're rejecting the premise of the question.
I mean, it drops from 7 to 4. 4 is still a lot of inflation. It does drop then below target after that, because prices fall away and that comes out of the base. But the other thing to bear in mind is that inflation works through the UK economy partly with a lag. It hits pump prices immediately. Oil prices makes petrol more expensive at the pumps, but it doesn't hit energy bills, as we will all find out next month, until they change the price cap, which happens in April. That goes up a lot in April. It'll hit us again in October to reflect whatever happens to prices between April and October. But so it takes a while for inflation to feed through to the domestic economy through energy prices. And we've also, as Gemma pointed out, we've increased our nominal wages forecast to reflect the fact that we think there's going to be some knock-on effect for wages. But that also takes time, because it's got to reflect the fact that people's cost of living is gradually rising. They've got to move jobs if they're going to get pay rises these days. So it does take some time. So I think our inflation is fairly persistent compared to what we thought before other economists did.
There you go, John. That tells you. The right, Alistair. There's a few questions along these lines, but Alistair's got capitals in his, so we thought we should have Alistair's question, which is basically, now, I'm going to do a less in capitals version of this question, okay? And there's a bit of what Robert was saying here to join up, which is, if we think about this, the task facing central banks, at least how they're thinking about this phase, is inflation is higher than we'd like it to be. We need it brought down. That at minimum means normalising our interest rates, and definitely in the US case means planning to go above what we think normal interest rates look like to squeeze out some inflation that risks getting entrenched. There's a path between... The question is, how wide is the path that sees you doing that, successfully getting rid of the inflation, but not causing a recession? Yeah, and compared to where we were in the autumn, the like width of that path has narrowed. And the question is, and obviously, and there's a few other questions, some of them are less polite in saying, is it impossible for the OBR to predict a recession until it's actually happened? So, you know, but what do we actually think is the, how wide is the path that means we can get from here to back to our low inflation world or target inflation world without causing a recession, either because of rates doing it, but realistically, actually, it's the hit to it's the hit from energy prices and falling incomes is actually going to be doing most of the work in terms of squashing demand. So, Richard, come on, odds of a recession.
So I'm not going to put odds on it, but we're not predicting a recession for several reasons. One is that we still have some catch up growth to do from the pandemic. There are people who left the labour market during the pandemic who we still expect to come back. A number of those are students who spent some more time in higher education and will hopefully come back into the labour market with more skills as a result. So you've got more people coming out of higher education back into the labour market who we lost during the pandemic but get back. There are people who want to work longer hours than they are now and will hopefully get an opportunity to do so in the coming years. And there is also consumption is supported by the fact that not only are people coming back into the labour market working longer hours, but some people were able to build up savings during the pandemic. And we do expect faster drawdown of those savings over the medium term, as some of which supports consumption at a time when people are feeling the cost of living squeeze. So there are reasons to believe that there's enough to support demand and there's enough to support employment going out over the next few years to offset the fact there's a big hit from inflation to people's consumption.
Okay, very good. Okay, we'll look forward to your percentage chance of a recession once it's happened, when it will be 100%. And if it doesn't happen, it will be 0%. And that is the boldness we look for in our forecasters. Right, now, totally unfairly, Gemma, right, let's go on to the public finances. So we've touched mainly on the big news is tax receipts are coming in. I'm going to come back to you in a second to explain why on earth tax receipts are coming in, because everyone's easy to write versions this morning say high inflation means we've had more tax receipts, which isn't really actually what's going on. So, warning, you can explain that in 5 seconds. But on the downside, in the debt interest world, you've got one set of people saying debt interest costs are going absolutely through the roof. It's like Armageddon, the world's about to end. They're broadly sitting on the kind of rightward side of the spectrum. And then you've got the left shouting back saying, there's literally no problem whatsoever on debt interest costs. Why is everyone getting excited? All calm down. Now, the question we've got here from the panel, and we have the person in the room who's actually selling this debt to the market, so good luck. We're all rooting for you in the months ahead. But the question is, how much of this is about what's going on with interest rates and quantitative easing versus how much of this is to do with temporary high inflation? And then what does that lead in terms of how worried you are? What's your anxiety levels out of 10 on debt interest costs?
Okay, I might slightly defer part of this question to Richard because I confess I haven't looked at the relevant detailed bit of...
That's very unfair, no worry. Give us the bit you want to answer.
So it is both of those things, because both of those things feed through, and in part because of quantitative easing and how much of the debt is being held by the Bank of England and the way that scores in the public finances, the increase in base rate has quite a big impact.
A quick one.
A big and quick impact on debt interest costs to the government. On how worried I am, so you're right, you kind of alluded to in the way you put the question that there's a very big increase in debt servicing costs in the near term, and then there's still a pretty big, £9 billion a year, I think, increase in debt servicing costs beyond that, which is kind of dwarfed by the short-term increase, which is so dramatic, a sort of £40 billion increase, but actually, in normal times, that's still a £9 billion big increase in debt servicing costs. It's, so my take on sort of how worried should we be is medium term, we can't afford to just not worry at all about how much the government is borrowing. There definitely is a borrowing constraint on the government. The Chancellor's fiscal rules are broadly sensible, I would say. I mean, you can argue about how quickly do you need debt to be falling precisely, but it's kind of in that ballpark. In the near term, there is much less of a borrowing constraint on the government. The government could afford to borrow more and offer more support to households. So the Chancellor made a choice in that sense of how much fiscal support to offer to the households this year.
Very good. James, just more broadly, do you want to come on this? Like, I mean, obviously in the very short term, this, so remind everyone, there's two things going on. There's higher RPI inflation pushing up the cost of our index-linked gilts. In brackets, we don't actually pay that money for like years. We pay it over 30 years because it increases. It's not about money going out the door in the next year, but it scores in the public sector borrowing figures for next year. And then there's actually higher interest rates on our stock of debt.
I mean, it felt like you just did it. But anyway, the key thing here, though, is what we're still in and what we have been experiencing is an incredibly low interest rate environment. So if we were to get interest rates to go up to something like more normal pre-pandemic levels, that would be good news, people. So it would probably be telling us that the economy is actually normalising, heading back from this incredibly crunching period of low growth and low interest rates. You're right, the specific point that the UK has with it around a quarter to a third of its stock linked to RPI, and if I can follow Gemma in making a nerdy point, RPI is the difference between RPI and CPI is unusually large at the moment as the weights play catch up. So that's obviously adding to...
We literally just lost half the audience.
To all of this. So that's a particular UK thing. But if we got rates rising, I think, you know, we would be seeing more good news for the Chancellor. Because
there we go. Look, James, you win the prize for the first perky thing. Right, come on.
Well, there was just a point that sort of it's been weighing on me for years. I mean, what this shows, right, is the extent to which we lived through this very long period of people, saying low inflation, low interest rates are, the new permanent normal. And we just lived through an absolutely typical period of human history, and this happens about every 20 years, where we forget the previous 300 years of history. Let's be absolutely clear: this was a government decision to borrow in an index-linked way because they thought that was going to be the cheapest way of borrowing because inflation was never going to rise again. And it was a government decision to, authorise the Bank of England to buy 175 billion quid's worth of their debt, which links now government debt to short-term interest rates, right? That's what it does. One of the things, I actually tried to talk to Simon Clark, the Chief Secretary on the Treasury, about this last night, and I basically said, this is a Tory mistake, isn't it? Because all of this happened since 2010.
That's why they love coming on the show.
Yeah.
that's what they're
there. And, I know this is a techie issue, but if we don't examine this stuff and we don't learn that these things are not forever, we just repeat these mistakes. And at the end of the day, people like us don't pay the price. The people who pay the price are, the people whose, real incomes are going to fall 5-6% over the next. And the other thing we just haven't really talked about, because I should have really mentioned this, the thing I don't know, the big political thing I don't know is, we've got benefits, universal credit going up by 3.1% in a couple of weeks' time. If the government sticks to plan, it'll be another year before, the benefits and universal credit rise in line with what's actually happening to prices. I just don't know. I just don't know what people think, whether it is sustainable for the government to wait that long. I'm assuming you built into your forecasts that the government will wait a full year.
Yeah.
But if they don't wait a full year, That's quite a significant change. And I think it's going to be a nightmarish few months. I think there's going to be massive protests about all of this. The other thing that I asked Simon Clark about last night was, are you really going to tell nurses and teachers they're going to have a pay cut? He said, yes, that's what they're going to do. Again, do we really think they're going to be able to hold this? I don't know. I mean, but it's going to be the politics of this is going to be execrable for this government over the coming few months. My sort of slightly I suppose cheap point is I did wonder yesterday whether anybody had bothered to explain any of this to the Prime Minister, and I still don't really know, having heard him on the radio this morning. I don't think he quite understands the magnitude.
Who's the Chancellor or the Prime Minister? Which one did you?
I wonder whether the Chancellor would bother to explain to the Prime Minister. Okay. I heard the Prime Minister was on LBC this morning, being very chirpy about everything that Rishi had announced. And I just thought to myself, has Rishi really told you what's going on? So this is a mess.
Right. You always bring us back down. As soon as James gives us a little spark of optimism, so the answer is obviously the forecasts are based on government policy.
Yes. Yes.
And the law being that.
Yes.
So let's try phrasing this in a way which might get some kind of answer out of you, which does history say that governments always stick to spending plans when bad stuff happens during the year ahead?
No. And I suppose, even recent history shows that, this is a government which does basically takes it 6 months at a time. Mm. Look at the way the furlough scheme worked. It was originally introduced for a period of months, and then as the pandemic carried on, it got extended and extended. And so one of the things which led us to keep having to revise our forecast, and I should say both for the public finances, but also for the economy, because our forecasts were based on the furlough scheme coming to an end, people being put back onto a labour market that was still recovering from the pandemic. In the end, the Chancellor ended up aligning the end of the furlough scheme with what turned out to be what we hope was close to the end of the pandemic, or the worst of it for us. And so people did have jobs to go back to, and we didn't see a big rise in unemployment, but you didn't see the end of that plan until you got to the end of the process. It was not announced in that way. I think there is a sense that because there's so much uncertainty about what's happening with energy prices and inflation, you see a government that's waiting and seeing.
And to be fair to the Chancellor, he basically said that this morning on his media round. He basically said, look, if things are really tough in the autumn, you can have some more money, bluntly. He didn't use the word money, obviously. but that was the indication of what he was saying on his media round this morning. If you listen to what he's saying, he's quite open. Right, let's take two questions from the humans. Go ahead, sir.
And Phil Aldrich at Bloomberg. When we were talking about interest rate rises and also the cost of living squeeze, there's a 2.2% cost of living squeeze coming. Have you done any calculations or estimates of how much of that is caused by rising interest rates? Which interest rates are expected to get up to around 2%. So, how much is the bank going to be bearing down on people? And also, just on the point which you were touching on, Torsten, on how is the economy so tax rich nowadays? How do they snaffle so much more of our tax?
We need the snaffle question.
Raising the tax rates.
Right, gosh.
On the first of it, I can't give you a precise number, but it'll be a lot smaller than just the impact of higher inflation than interest rates, just because interest rates aren't going up by anywhere near as much as inflation is. That has a much bigger impact on that figure. On why is the economy proving to be so much more tax rich? It's a number of things. We've got three different boxes in our document for people who really want to read about it.
They don't.
And we
you can see in the eyes.
you did ask the question, Phil. There's broadly speaking three things going on. One is that we seem to have gotten through the pandemic with the tax base just in better health and better shape. And in particular, there have been some sectors which have turned out. Where wages and incomes have held up very well, and profits have held up very well, and then the financial sector is one of them. The financial sector profits increased between 2019 and 2021, which is a surprise for people. Salaries in those kind of sectors, especially amongst professionals, held up very well and even grew during that period. And as you saw from the Resolution Foundation's charts, an awful lot of the changes in tax policy affect people at the top end. That's because an awful lot of our tax comes from people at the top end. So when those people do well, we get a lot more in tax. That is what seems to have happened over the course of the pandemic on the personal tax side. There's also an element of getting a bit more fiscal drag from the fact that we've seen an inflation surprise dragging more people into the tax system and then more of their income into higher tax brackets. So that's the second factor. The third thing is on the corporation tax side, you know, partly because the Chancellor pumped a lot of money into the corporate sector during the pandemic, they ended up making much higher profits, or were indeed profitable during the pandemic. And after. And as a result, corporations pay corporation tax on their profits. And so because profits held up by more, they paid more corporation tax. And then the third thing is, corporations invested less than we thought over the last year. And that really reflects the supply bottleneck problems that everybody's been coping with in the business world. You know, they couldn't get the inputs, they couldn't do the investment. And as a result, because investment's lower, there were fewer write-offs against
it. Right, let's get the last one. I want to vaguely finish this on time. I mean, I'm going to fail, but like vaguely. Right, one question from the room, and then we'll just power through the policy section of this.
Yeah, very quickly, Tom. First of all, I think the answer to Robert's question is it'll be when in October the energy price cap for the next 6 months is set. He has a packet. He has the power to spend significantly more helping people on that. Mm. Than was possible before. And secondly, in answer to Gemma's question on is there a tax strategy, I think it's pretty clear that he's a base broadener. He wishes to bring more, he's extended NI, even though, of course, he did there cut the rate. He's been happy to ride inflation bringing people into income tax. He lowered the repayment threshold for graduate repayments. I think he is a base broadener, and then, if possible, politically, a rate cutter. And that is a strategy. It's not 100% clear, but I think those are his instincts.
There you go. Look, that was David Willetts, their RN president, giving you the case that there is a strategy there. Again, thanks, Burgess. Right, I want to quickly now power through the policy section. I'm going to give you one quick question each. You have to quick answers, people. So, right, Gemma, just do benefits first. Okay, so the big gap in the spring statement is we've got a cost of living squeeze that's hardest for those on lowest incomes to manage because it's focused on the cost of essentials basically going on, and it is those people he's chosen not to give more money to. What is the effect of it? What's going to happen? Is he going to change his mind?
So the effect of it, I think it was quite clear, as you said, lower income households are going to face a bigger squeeze from the rising prices. There was nothing that was really targeted on them either in the February announcements or in yesterday's announcements. I think it is interesting, and I don't know why, but the Chancellor does seem averse to doing things through the benefit system. He worked quite hard in February to do measures to get money to households that didn't use the benefit system or existing support for energy costs like the warm homes discount and that sort of thing. What's going to be the impact? I think it's exactly the point that Robert was making. This is going to be a big squeeze on household incomes, hitting most those who have least flex in their budgets. As was mentioned, a lot of middle and higher income households built up savings during the pandemic. Those at the bottom didn't, both because their incomes were hit harder and they faced higher increases in their living costs during the pandemic. So I think it remains to be seen, but that is, I think, the big thing that is going to play out over the next few months.
We didn't show it in James's chart earlier, but sitting behind that distribution analysis we did overnight of different kinds of households, if you look at just out-of-work households, remember, who had their universal credit level cut in the autumn, didn't benefit from the taper rate change and don't benefit at all from the national insurance rise, even though even working households on universal credit don't benefit from it much. But if you look at out-of-work households, next year their incomes are falling by 8% is what's sitting behind those figures there. And we're talking about disabled people, we're talking about people who are not working for very good reasons. 8% fall next year. Not a penny of help is really going to go to those households, except if they apply to their council. That is what a mistake looks like. Right, hard one for you then, James. A few people have been tweeting about this to me overnight. So we had a fuel duty cut. Are they actually going to get it at the pump? This person's been walking the streets to find out.
Oh, right. Well, I think
you haven't, because you're in central London where no one drives.
That's the way to do it. I mean, you know, fuel duty cut was basically inevitable. It's what every country has done. I'm sure we'll see a big chunk of it pass through. I'm sure the companies will be under a lot of pressure to pass it through. The key thing, as I said earlier, is this goes to people who drive, and people who drive are on higher incomes, and it only takes the edge off the rise that we're seeing. And we see oil at $128 a barrel this morning. There's more of this to come. So
Okay, all right. You were the perky one before. Now you've gone all sulky on us. Right, let's leave the questions from the audience there and then go to like final words on where this all leaves us. As everyone has said, it's obviously much easier to see where this leaves us in the really short term, which is the year ahead's really tough. All of our prices are going up more than our incomes, and that's particularly true for those at the bottom. It's much harder to see where this leaves us in the years ahead, because the economic uncertainty is high, and as Robert was saying earlier, that means the political uncertainty is also pretty high. But you're on a panel, you chose to be on the panel, so you're going to have to give us a go at saying what is going on. So, James, what's coming up?
Well, I think the big thing here for me is that the best way to take out insurance against the recession for the Chancellor would have been to help people on the lowest income. So that everyone else, the middle and the top, was doing well coming out of the pandemic. They had a big rise in their house prices. They'd save more. All this makes me more worried about a recession, particularly in the context of, you know, the big cuts in government spending. So we're going to see 300,000 public sector workers that came in during the pandemic, they're going to have to go back out into the as public services collapse back after the pandemic. So, you know, the big worry is the Chancellor just has to come back and do a lot more very soon, basically.
Okay. And we didn't get into this earlier, but although GDP has fully recovered, it's basically public sector output up, private sector output still down on where we were before the pandemic. Gemma, unfair question number two to you.
So, Rishi Sunak has kind of spent most of his chancellorship trying to get to the point where he's not in crisis mode and he can think about the longer term. As Robert said, I think we've been spent quite a long time trying to figure out and discern a kind of serious economic strategy from the government. We started to get more of that in Sunak's May's lecture a few weeks ago, and he sort of tried to hint at more of that coming with the tax strategy and things. That would definitely be a positive direction of travel. I think there's a lot more detail to be seen to flesh that out and really make it into a serious economic strategy. But I think James is probably right that actually he may well just get overtaken in the near term by the continued economic uncertainty, the need to come back in the autumn for more help for households.
Very good. Richard?
Well, I mean, this is my second once-in-a-lifetime shock. In the job at the OBR, and I've only been in it for 18 months.
Wait a second. Terrible appointment.
And I think as Robert said, the thing about the pandemic was that science came to the rescue, and it provided a vaccine which has basically allowed our lives to more or less return to normal. And in some ways, for some people, I think changed them for the better, because it allowed them to work from home, spend more time with their families. And so in that sense, we emerged from the pandemic relatively unscathed, thanks to the miracles of science. Robert's point about, you know, kind of what is the way out of this shock, I think is a really good question. At the moment, we're hoping the way out of the shock is that it somehow resolves itself, energy prices go back down, and we can go back to the way in which we usually consume energy and run our economy. If that's not the case, and if, you know, if prices don't fall back, if we face a permanently different geopolitical situation than we have now, then there's a painful job of adjusting our economic mix to be much less dependent on oil and gas, which is where we are at the moment. You know, we get 3/4 of our energy from this stuff. If it's going to suddenly be much more expensive in future, we're not currently assuming that has a long-term scarring effect on the economy and impact on potential. If prices remain high for much longer, then that does have an impact on our ability to produce things efficiently over the long term, and we have to think much more seriously about where we get energy from.
Let's hope that's not your next forecast. Robert.
So I suppose the one thing that I've noticed is that there's been no discussion at all today of the Chancellor's so-called rabbit, the promise to cut income tax in a couple of years' time. Now, David may well be right that Rishi does genuinely have this idea that the way to run a modern economy is to broaden the base and to cut rates. That may well be right. But I have to say, when he announced that, I felt very uncomfortable because, you know, as we all been discussing, these are serious challenges, these are worrying times. And it felt a bit trivial to me. It felt like a nod to some of the people on his back benches who are just a bit uneasy about the overall direction of the government, at a time when I felt that he should be telling a serious story to the British people I slightly feel that they'll rue the day that they made that promise. Because all he's really done is for a sort of what he helped was a little bit of potential good news. He's actually created the big risk that when it comes to it, we won't be able to afford it. I suppose the question I just leave is, you know, whether or not, because up to now one had felt that Rishi Sunak looked like a sort of serious chancellor. And I just felt he did himself a bit of damage there. I think I'll leave it there.
All right. I think we should say thank you to our rather depressing panel this morning for all their insights. I need to say thank you very much to James and the whole Resolution Foundation team for damaging their sleep, but aiding our understanding of what has been announced yesterday. And slightly ending on where Robert said, I mean, big picture, insofar as the Chancellor himself basically said he had two jobs, which was to protect households this year and cut taxes in future, the budget definitely doesn't do that. And so the real issue is both for us as all as consumers and as households and as part of the economy, and for him as the Chancellor, the future is pretty tough because the world is as it is, not as we'd like it to be. And on that happy note, have a good day, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.